So I take it that many of you in this room know what we're talking about when we mention documentary linguistics, but just as a reminder, Himmelmann's definition, that it's about methods, tools, and theory in relation to putting together a representative and lasting multipurpose record of a language. A similar kind of definition is to be found in Tony Woodbury's chapter on documentary linguistics in the Cambridge Handbook of Endangered Languages that will be available for you to buy your own personal copy of next month, The Creation, Annotation, Preservation and Dissemination of Transparent Records of a Language. So that's what language documentation is about, and its goal is to produce such records. The point that I want to sort of emphasize and that the rest of the talk will be about is that in this process of creating such records, metadata plays a crucial role. So what's metadata? Basically, in a word, metadata is data about data. And we need information about the data that we're collecting to identify it, to manage it, and to retrieve it. This, I emphasize here, this so far has nothing to do with archiving. We're simply talking about our own research, finding stuff on our own computers, identifying it, and managing the data. It provides the context and the understanding for that data. Okay, so this particular sound file, why did I record it? Who's speaking? What's it about? What's its significance? The metadata will answer those questions. The important value of metadata is that it carries the understandings, not only understandings that I will have, but it carries those understandings into the future and to other people. And that's why it's important when it comes to preservation and archiving. So we need metadata to do our own work, to identify, manage, and understand our own data, but the value is we can then transfer that understanding to others now and into the future. The other important aspect of metadata is that it reflects the knowledge and the practices of the people who provide the data. So when we record our metadata, we're actually making some statements about what we know. We can't record metadata for things that we don't know about, right? So our knowledge is represented in the metadata. Another aspect of metadata is that it, by its nature, defines and constrains the audiences and the ways that people can use that data. So if I set up the metadata and take account of certain categories, that will have restrictions on what the categories are that people can search for or try to understand the nature of the data. As my colleague David Nathan and I have argued some 7 years ago, all value adding for recordings that we make in language documentation is metadata. So everything that we add to a recording, all the annotations, the transcriptions, the glosses, the part of speech tags, the genre information, and so on, is all metadata. And therefore, it's very fundamental when it comes to language documentation. Now, so far, up to now, most of the recommendations about what metadata should look like in language documentation have primarily been influenced by work that's gone on in the area of library sciences in particular. So notions like Dublin Core, and the key concepts that have been promoted in language documentation have been interoperability, standardization, discovery, and access. So if you look at, for example, the Open Language Archives community, they emphasize you should have a basic metadata set in order to enable the discovery of those resources for other people to find them and to classify them and to do that in a standardized fashion. So for example, the language that's represented, you might want to have a standard ISO language code in your metadata to enable the interoperability and discovery and access. But language documentation has very broad goals, including involvement and feedback to the speech community from with whom we collaborate in order to do our research. And what I want to suggest to you is that this kind of system, based on Dublin Core or extensions, focusing primarily on standardization and interoperability, is not powerful enough to handle the knowledge and understandings and passing that to other people and to the future that we need for our language documentation work. And in fact, we have no theory of metadata, but we need such a theory in order to be able to achieve the goals of language documentation. So if you look in, say, the recommendations that you get from OLAC or from other sources, there are various sorts of metadata. I've listed some of them here. Information about who the people are involved in the project, some description of the content of the data, some administrative material like the date material or relationships between, say, a recording and a transcription, that's administrative metadata. Preservation metadata would be things like the file format, so that if we want to preserve that material, we need to know, is that file format still accessible? Do we need to update it or change it to the latest version of the software and so on? And finally, access and usage protocols. So those of you who attended David Nathan's talk this morning, he talks about the system that's used at SOAS called IRCS, where you have universal access, researcher access, community access, and then subscriber access, where the where there's an individual relationship between the person who wants to see the material and the person who collected it. Metadata can be assigned to individual files, or it can be assigned to bundles of files, or even to whole collections of files. So the kind of DOBES model used at the Max Planck Institute in Nijmegen and in many DOBES projects is to have a multi-layer hierarchical system of a project that contains several corpuses, that contains sessions, and each session contains items, and we can assign metadata to any of the levels. So for a particular corpus, you might assign, for instance, a language code, because that whole corpus is about a single language or multiple languages. At a session level, you might assign things like the date of the session, and then the items would be things like the transcription, the video file, and so on. So how do we store metadata? Well, the typical way linguists do it is that they store it in their heads. The problem is that, as I say here, it degrades rapidly, and it's not preservable or portable. It's very difficult to get the stuff out of your head and help somebody else understand. So if you listen to somebody else's sound file, it's really helpful to know what they know about that sound file. And if it's all in their memory, then it's pretty difficult. Another way that we often do it is on paper, scribble down some notes about who we've recorded or whatever. This is also difficult because it's not easily searchable or extensible. Some people put the metadata into the files themselves. So a very common thing would be if you're making a recording of an interview, to at the beginning of the recording to say, this is Peter Austin speaking to Lalu Dasmara on such and such a date, in such and such a place, in such and such a language, about such and such a topic. So the actual file itself contains that information, or you'd have a header at the top of a text file or whatever. Again, this is not extensible or really easily searchable. Linguists also love to put metadata into the names of the files and the folders that they use. So you end up with systems like susjbkpka0. That's actually quite a reasonable one. There are some that are even more horrendous than that one. The problem is this breaks very, very easily. It's very easy to forget what your system is and get confused. And I can stuff semantics into there, like sus is the Sasak language, but there's all sorts of semantics and knowledge and meaning that can't be stuffed into the file names. Otherwise, they'd be way too big and impossible to manage. So we need a system of metadata. We have to have an organized system. There are many different systems that people use. The simplest and easiest one is free text. Just write some simple text. What you have here is a file named file number one, and it is da 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 da. And if you just write that, somebody else can attempt to understand it. Structured text using word tables, a spreadsheet, a database, a metadata system. So IMDIM is a metadata manager. There's a very nice one that SIL is working on at the moment. Saymore, which is easy and accessible. Or any combination. You might have a mixture or a combination of these that allow you to do what you want to do and do it in a flexible and sufficiently expressive manner. There's no simple solution. There's no one-size-fits-all. You, as the researcher, need to work out what you're comfortable with. But the important thing here is you need to specify what it is that you know about the data so other people can understand it, so you can use it, so you can organize it, you can find things. Now, so I've been talking about metadata, but metadata is actually part of a specification of a broader sort of concept, which is meta-documentation. So documentation is the collection and organization of a corpus. Meta-documentation is the documentation of that documentation. So it's recording things like, how was the data collected? Why did you collect this particular material rather than some other thing? What's the kind of logic behind that? I'll come back to the categorization of that in a few moments. This quote is from a presentation by my colleague David Nathan, and I emphasize the bit that he's got here. Meta documentation should be as rich and appropriate as the documentary materials themselves. And I think there's a huge gap here that documentary linguistics has really missed. We've had a big discussion and big debates about what does language documentation consist of, file formats, transcription styles, software for doing all of this kind of stuff. But the metadata has been left crippled and really not properly expressed. And it's nowhere near as rich as what we are doing on the documentary side. So meta-documentation is the documentation of documentation. It has to do with the models, processes, and outcomes of our research as we do documentary linguistics. The goals of developing an approach to meta-documentation would be to help us understand ways of presenting and using language documentations. Again, David Nathan talked about this morning, and his idea is archives can serve as a way of publishing documentations. And we need to start thinking about what those publication frameworks might look like. Meta-documentation will help us understand that. It'll also help us have future preservation of the outcomes of current documentation projects. It's a simple fact of life. Linguists and researchers come and go. Somebody comes, works on a language for 3 years, if you're lucky, 5 years, and then they go and get a real job working for a computer science computer company or working for McDonald's or something. And all of that material is perhaps saved or stored in an archive. If we're lucky, it's been stored. But what about all the understandings about who the people were and how the project was carried out? That's where meta-documentation comes in. It also, I think, is going to be fundamental for sustainability of our field and continuation. Helps future researchers to learn from the successes and the failed experiments of people who are currently grappling with the challenges of doing language documentation. I'm going to show you an example of this when we look at some legacy materials in a few moments. So what we're doing today, we can help future researchers by telling them what worked and what didn't work in our research projects. And as Lisa Conathan points out in the Cambridge Handbook, we can document intellectual property contributions and career trajectories. So you can point people to say, this is how my career developed. Look at these meta documentations of what I've been doing. Now, meta documentation requires a level of reflexivity by linguists concerning their own models, processes, and practices. Linguistics, as against other fields, has noticeably not engaged in reflexive thinking. And what we should, I suggest, do is look at other areas like social and cultural anthropology, archaeology, archiving, museum studies to get some ideas about the sorts of considerations that might turn out to be useful for us. So what I'm going to propose now is that if we want to approach a theory of metadocumentation, there are kind of three different attacks that we could make on it. One would be a deductive approach, where we set forward a set of axioms and theorems. We say if you want to document your documentation, these are some good things to take account of. An inductive approach would be to look at what people are doing in their documentation and try and understand that and summarize it and come up with some conclusions, some operating principles that people are working on. And a third possibility would be a comparative approach, which would be to look at what documenters are doing and then look in other relevant fields. One which might strike you as very strange, but actually I think is very relevant, is archaeology. Because archaeologists are very much focused on documentation of the primary recordings, the field sites where they work, and then the sets of interpretations and metadata that they assign to that. So, very quickly, there are a bunch of metadata formats that have been proposed from a deductive approach. So MD is one, OLAC is another, EAD is another. There are others, the library sciences have MARC and so on. And individual organizations like the archive at SOAS, the Latin American Archive in Texas, or Paradisec in Australia, have their own sets of metadata, and they sometimes allow depositors to make up their own. But there's a yawning gap in the coverage that these metadata proposals miss out. And let me just mention some that seem to me to be major issues that we should be thinking about. I'm not saying this list is definitive. There surely are others, but these are some that strike me. The identity of the stakeholders involved and their roles in the project. We might record, for example, the name of the person that's speaking on the recording, but surely there are others involved in the project in other ways, like perhaps their children who are also participants in some way, or the people who organised for the project to take place, although their voices are not actually recorded, and so on. The attitudes that the language consultants take towards their languages and also towards the documentation project itself. Did they give a damn about it, or did they care, or how were they involved? How did it change and develop over the period of time that the project was taking place? The relationships between the consultants and community and the researcher themselves. It's okay, we can confess, they hated me when I first turned up, but, you know, after a period of time we managed to work out da-da-da-da-da. Now, some of this information obviously would be very private, and it may be stuff that you don't want to share. That's fine. We have control. We can control the access to our material. If you put it in an archive, you simply place it under closed access that nobody else is allowed to look at. So Jeff Good mentions, for example, how did you make contact with the community? How did you get consent? What compensation did you set up? What arrangements did you make in order to compensate the people involved? And the particular culture of documentation that was involved. The goals and methodology of the researcher. Why did you set out to do this project? What methods did you use? Did they work? If they didn't work, what did you then do to replace them? And so on. And any theoretical assumptions. One that I find really important is the biography of the project. I want to know things like, when the person made this recording, how much fieldwork had they already done? And had they worked on this language or some other language? Maybe they knew something about the language family, and so they approached the recording process with particular things in mind, and so on. So I'm writing a grammar of an Australian Aboriginal language at the moment, and in chapter one, I actually go through and explain. I was an undergraduate student, I did this and this, and I published this, and so on. A CV, essentially, so that someone who comes to my work can understand the context of the material that's there. Now, if your project is funded by a grant, then you might want to include things like your grant application, any reports that you made, emails back and forth to the grantors and so on, would be part of the matter documentation. Any agreements that you entered into, whether they were formal agreements or informal promises to keep. So I was recently in Indonesia doing field work. When I left, people asked me if I could do X, Y, and Z, and I said, sure, no problem. Well, I better document that because I forget, or they, you know, remind me later or whatever. That's part of the meta documentation. And relationships between a given project and other projects, either on the same language or in other languages. Maybe you want to know when you're looking at my documentation that actually I think Nicholas Himmelmann's research on Waimaa is fantastic and I've adopted his model. Right? That might be helpful for you to understand my documentation and my approach. And no doubt there are others. Okay, that's not a limit. I'm simply saying we need to think reflexively about our own behavior and our own approaches. Okay, moving on to an inductive approach. This would be to look at current and past approaches. And here I'll just mention two things very briefly. David Nathan has looked at the metadata practices of a group of people who've deposited in the ELA archive and looking at what metadata it is that they're recording. And if I have time, which I doubt, I'll just mention some issues that have come up when I've been working with legacy materials. Okay, so David, this is a summary of a paper that he gave at the LSA in Pittsburgh last month. He worked on 50 deposits, looking at the metadata categories and explored those and was really interested in understanding what metadata it was that linguists were adding to their deposits. So basically 80% of the metadata categories that linguists were assigning to their deposits can be mapped directly to OLAC. Okay, so about 80% match up to things like the language, the speaker, the file format, and so on. That's pretty good. OLAC must be happy that linguists have kind of got the message that roughly OLAC categories are pretty good things to have, and most linguists seem to be doing that. But there are a lot of other categories, like metadata in Spanish, indigenous genres, the number of children that somebody has, the languages that a person can hear, that is, understand, as against the languages they can speak, or the consultant's education level, or the date they left home, they left the country where they were working, or the workflow status or the biography of the project description, some people actually doing that meta documentation of the biography. And there's more. In fact, there's 631 of them. So what David discovered is that there is a kind of what he called, using Anderson's term, the long tail of information. Okay, so there's one term that occurs in 20 of the 50, two terms that occur in 17, and so on. But look down the bottom. 613 terms that occur only once in people's descriptions. Okay, so what's happening is linguists, if they're told to, produce very rich and comprehensive metadata that relates to their own particular project that may be unique and different and special from anybody else's project. Actually, if you tell them, we want you to do the best metadata, you want to do the best description, we'll do lots and lots and lots of diverse description. And what he argues, and I again emphasize here, is that the theory of metadata is for us to discover, not for us to predefine, perhaps, but to discover from experience. My legacy example is from work I've been doing with materials collected by the late Stephen Vaughan in the 1950s. Quite challenging because it's glossed in a sort of phonetic transcription. It's in a phonetic transcription with glosses in Hungarian shorthand. Luckily, I was able to work with Stephen before he passed away, and he translated all the glosses into English for me, and I created documents that look something like this, which is the transcription copied literally from his field notes with his translations. So what about the meta documentation? you know, what do I need to know in order to be able to work on this? What do I know, and what would I really have liked to know that I can't find out now? Well, orthography. His transcription is nowhere documented. We have no idea. Well, we can guess what some of those symbols kind of represent, but it actually turns out it's sort of like IPA, but it's actually highly over-differentiated in some ways and under-differentiated in other ways. Fortunately, we have about 10 minutes of tape recording, so I can go back and map some of the sentences that he recorded. It would have been so much easier if he'd actually documented what his methodology was. The annotations are a problem. Luckily, Stephen translated those. Word boundaries are sometimes incorrect. There's cryptic glossing. It's pretty clear when you analyze morpheme by morpheme that what he's given as a glossing is just wrong in terms of the component morphemes that make it up. How he got the glosses, we don't know. I guess he asked people and they told him in English or something, and he translated it into Hungarian and then back to English. There was changing understanding over time. So the transcription on the first page is not the same as the transcription on the 130th page, because as he was working on the language, he was changing his transcription and kind of figuring out how the language worked as he went along. And fortunately, he makes a few comments along the way in the field notes about this morpheme probably marks that. He's actually wrong a couple of times, I think, but at least he gave us some signposts on that. We know nothing about the stakeholders. We know who the name of the speaker, but we have no idea about that speaker or their relationships, and there are real problems with protocol. Okay, my conclusions. Documentary linguistics hasn't paid sufficient attention so far to the nature functions and expressive power of metadata. We have no theory of metadata. Preoccupations with standardization driven by typologists and data scrapers and fetishization of interlinear glossing have narrowed our focus on metadata and metadocumentation. And we need more reflexivity and exploration in order for the field to develop further in the future. Thank you.
Time for one or two questions.
Yes, thank you. You raised one point in there that I think is maybe quite controversial, and it has to do with whether the metadata is accessible or not. We've generally, in past discussions, thought of